Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 328 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry and Chance. How are you this evening?
I am doing amazing because it's the Arctic Express is en route, starting to come in right now as we speak.
And what is your low going to be?
Not bad tonight, only 15.
Only 15. A chance, and that's centigrade, correct?
Centigrade.
No, it's not centigrade.
What would you do, Chance, if it were 15 degrees where you are?
Oh, I think I'd just probably roll up and die, I think.
Well, welcome. I completely botched it up last week to introduce you at the beginning of the show. So welcome back again. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
How far are you away from whatever the San Bernardino, is that what it is? The winds? How far are you from that?
Roughly a little over an hour.
That's not too far. Are you able to see like glowing on the horizon? Are you getting smoke?
No, you know, there were weather conditions I did not see. Now during the fires, no, not really.
Okay. Interesting. Because, God, that, like, there's a lot of destruction going on over there.
All That's around me. I just, you know, I've been busy.
All right. Well, please head over and press like, subscribe, support the podcast, 5-star rating, like, subscribe, notification bell. That's the other one, notification bell. If you could leave a 5-star review, if you would like to, that would be fantastic. It does make a difference. And then if you want to be incredibly generous, as the people that have joined us here in the live stream, they are all patrons, and I appreciate them all very much, each and every one of you. Larry, tell us what we are doing this evening.
Well, joining Mr. Gloom and Doom is Chance, which you've already introduced him. And so what we're doing, we have a question from Mark, who's a guest in the Federal Bureau of Prison System. And I think Chance will be discussing a recent California Supreme Court decision to allow placement of an SVP into the community. Also, we have a case from the Massachusetts Court of Appeals that deals with risk-based registration. It was about a person who wanted his risk level reduced. Not his tier level, his risk level. So that is going to be a good discussion. And that question from Mark, we're going to have a lot of fun with. So let's get this train on the road. Actually, it's on the track, not the road.
That is what it is. All right. Well, this is from Mark, who is in custody of the Federal Bureau of Prison. I've read a couple of the recent decisions striking down registry requirements to provide internet identifiers as violating the First Amendment because such a requirement discourages or suppresses free speech. Now, my question, could the requirement to report travel out of state not be challenged on a similar premise? We have a right to travel in the U.S., and a PFR had to get permission to travel. Oh, sorry, and if a PFR had to get permission to travel, that would constitute an unconstitutional restraint on the PFR's liberty, right? As you have often said, they get away with this because they only require you to report the travel, not get permission. But if it is unconstitutional to be required to report your internet identifiers because it may discourage or suppress a citizen from speaking freely, wouldn't it also be unconstitutional to require a PFR to report his travel because it may discourage or discourage or suppress that citizen's right to travel freely or to spend money in interstate commerce, which is a form of speech. Now, Mr. Barred Attorney, and that's not barred as in prevented, barred as in licensed to practice, what do you have to say about that?
Well, the requirement to report travel must be balanced against constitutional rights, such as the right to travel. Courts have generally upheld these requirements, considering them necessary for public safety and not an undue burden on the registrant's right to travel. The key is whether the requirement is reasonable and serves a legitimate government interest without being overly restrictive. What say you, Larry?
Well, I say it's a great question, and I had never really looked at this the way that Mark cast it. And so we appreciate a great question like this. I think there might be a little bit more to this there, because what you said is true and I agree with, but there's no due process. So it's the broad brush that concerns me. Every PFR in many jurisdictions has to do this, not just a certain select group that have been targeted with a narrow tailored requirement. This might actually be a challenge that would gain some traction if it were the right offender, you know, with the right challenger, the right set of facts. I think this might could gain some traction, because I've always said that since the law doesn't provide for last-minute travel, 21 days doesn't do a lot for last-minute travel if you've got to report it 21 days prior to departure. So I think this might be a way that we could expand upon my already existing theory to include that this inhibits or just flat out discourages travel, which is a fundamental right. So I think Mark might be onto something.
May I present a hypothetical for you?
Sure.
All right. So I will put out there that I would say that a supervising registry officer would have a more direct path to report your activities versus Joe Schmo, just a average citizen that observes you doing something. And if we were to take into context like the McCarthy era, where you were supposed to narc on your neighbors if they were doing communist-oriented behaviors, if you were going to listen to a professor speak at a college that had very socialist or communist kind of views, your neighbors would narc on you, if I'm not mistaken, of what that era was about. Do I have that roughly right?
You do.
Okay. Now, if you are a PFR and you have some kind of views in that regard, and you then ask for permission to travel out of state to exercise your First Amendment right to express whatever you want to express, and you ask to go to another state, and it happens to be something along those lines that might be, I don't want to say January 6th, but like that would be, hey, I would like to go to DC because there's going to be this big rally. And that turns into what it turned into. Then perhaps your officer that you have reported your travel to could report that you are one of the people and you were exercising your First Amendment right of freedom of association, exercising free speech. All that goes in there in the First Amendment.
Well, the way you've set that up, though, is not quite right, because you do not have to get permission. And you said it, when you're getting the permission to travel, you just give, as I understand it, the dates and the destination. So how would the registry officer know that you're going to go protest Trump's inauguration? How would they know that?
Well, certainly. So take some liberties of what I've said, that you're going out of state and they choose to not be in favor of what your activity is, and they report it to somebody. But the point being is that by you having to go tell them, maybe you would second guess your activity, that inhibited your First Amendment right, just by you having to second guess what you want to do with your First Amendment.
I could agree with that. Since I don't do this reporting, I don't know what all they ask for and how deeply they get into it. But if you simply say, I'm going to be going from Georgia to California, and I'll be back in 14 days, if that's all the information you have to give, how would they know what to report about your un-American activities if you're just simply saying your destination and the dates?
I'd have to think, Larry, that just reporting those things, the officers, are they literally just taking a form that says, I'm going to this place between these dates, here's where I will be, and when I will return? Like, they're not saying, hey, what's the reason for your trip? I got to think somebody's asking.
Well, we can throw that out to our massive audience. Or do they ask you when you're traveling what the purpose of your travel is? If you're under supervision, yes, they will give you a permit. But if you're merely registering, I'm not aware of any disclosure of the purpose of the travel having to be given. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm out of touch.
Well, it seems to me that this is really a international travel situation. And I think the toughest part of it, especially for those who get the marker on their passport, is that they're compelled to present that passport. And the marker really is speech. And so, you know, you're compelled to make that statement every time you enter a foreign destination. Very similar to what's being asked here. And I really think that these issues really should be sorted out. There was an attempt to do it a few years back with ACSOL. And that was really, I think the outcome of that was that the claims were untimely. But I think it is good. It's a good issue. It's a good First Amendment issue.
Well, so, Mark will be glad to hear that we didn't discount his question as being bogus, because I truly hadn't looked at it in the way he's presented it.
I'd heard that forever ago. God, I don't remember where. That just having like traffic cameras that can watch your movement could inhibit your movement because someone potentially is watching you, whether you're doing political speech, whether you're having an affair, like all that stuff could be inhibited just by there being traffic cams observing you that can change your behavior.
That I would agree with. If the Democrat Party is having an event at the Albuquerque Convention Center at 11 o'clock next Saturday, and you pull in and park at one of the lots adjacent to the convention center, it would be pretty safe bet that that's what you were going to, as the event at the convention center. If you knew that Big Brother was logging all that, it might prevent you from going to the Democrat Party's event. Yes, I can see that.
Cool. Case solved. PFRs, you don't have to tell them. Just don't. No. I didn't say that. Just my brain was thinking out loud.
So, well, I hope that this can be developed further. Got to be careful what I say, because I remember not that many months ago that someone took it literally that FYP and Registry Matters as a law firm, and we're not.
But I would really? Who said that? I don't remember hearing that.
Oh, well, I think you do remember the person that complained about us.
But, that person. Never mind. I remember that.
So, yes, but we're not a law firm. We happen to have an attorney on our team here, but this is not something we're likely to develop, but it seems like it's worthy of development. I agree with it.
Well, then, main event time?
Yeah, this is going to be wonderful. We didn't get to do it last week because it was on the schedule, but you had computer problems, and I was I was with a long-standing annual commitment that was going to be tough, so we just decided to not have a session last week.
Yep. Hey, and also, you're supposed to ask me about the sweatshirt I'm wearing.
Tell me about that shirt.
We got the FYP merch on, and it says, "It's not punishment. It's a civil regulatory scheme." You can go to fypeducation.org/shop and buy one just like it.
So I can see that. That's lovely.
It's a really nice shirt. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for helping design it there, my friend. Okay. Well, you have this case that you want to talk about from Massachusetts. Isn't that like the liberal bastion of the United States, pretty much?
Pretty much, yep. That's the biggest collection of Looney Tunes since the advent of the Third Reich.
You want me to press that button, don't you?
Run by the strangest collection of misfits, Looney Tunes, since the advent of the Third Reich.
And that was said by Ronald Reagan. Okay, and this is from their court of appeals. It is John Doe versus the PFR Registration Board. It is sadly a loss for us, and what do you want to discuss about it?
This case presents a unique perspective on the pitfalls of risk-based registration systems. We have so many people who believe it's the panacea and the cure-all, end-all, and so we're going to dive into it. Does have some advantages, and there'll be some disadvantages, and we'll get into that in this dissecting this case.
And you're here to flush it. We recently discussed a case from Massachusetts regarding a PFR and the board, and what's this one about?
Well, this one is a John Doe plaintiff, he appealed from the Superior Court judge's decision, which had affirmed the PFR board's classification of Mr. Doe as a level 3 offender. Doe had argued that the evidence did not support the level 3 classification and that the hearing examiner erred in denying his motion for expert funds. The appellate court affirmed the lower court's decision.
I will set this up a little bit. In July of 2016, Doe, then 20 years old, picked up a 14-year-old girl for whom he had befriended on Facebook. Doe gave a minor alcohol, and after she became intoxicated, drove to a back road and did not really great things with her in the car. The next day, the victim learned through Facebook posts from friends and family that she had been reported as a missing person. The victim asked Doe to take her home, but he began pressuring her for more sex. The victim said no several times. Doe got out of the car, went to the passenger side, and tried to grab the victim's pants in private areas. Eventually, the victim stopped resisting, and Doe did the things with her the second time. In June 2018, Doe pled guilty to 2 counts of rape and abuse of a child and was sentenced to 2.5 years. 2.5 years! Imprisonment with 18 months to serve and the balance suspended for 6 years. He was released on parole June 12th of 2020. This case is relatively new since he was only released 5-ish or so years ago. So what happened next?
Now take a look at that sentence. Now this is just off script, but he went and did some pretty naughty stuff and he got 2.5 years. Now what do you
think? That's why I repeated it.
What do you think he would have gotten in Florida or Alabama or Mississippi or Louisiana?
I assure you, if he would have did that in Georgia, he would have gotten at least 30.
Yeah.
So, but before we get into the board's evaluation, it's worthwhile to point out that in February 2017, while the charges of the index offenses were pending, that's the offenses we're talking about here, a 17-year-old girl reported to the Department of Children and Families that Doe forced her to perform sexual acts, sell prescription drugs, pills, and smoke marijuana. The girl, however, later recanted those allegations, stating that she and Doe had engaged in consensual activity. Although the hearing examiner did not treat this information as evidence of sexual abuse, she considered it as part of a concerning pattern, noting that both the girl and her mother agreed that Doe was persistent in pursuit of sexual activity with this girl.
And that's not all. In May of 2018, again while the charges on the index offense were pending, a woman reported to police that Doe was attempting to entice her 16-year-old daughter to have sex with him in exchange for pot. The girl disclosed that some weird guy had contacted her on Snapchat, asked if she smoked, and sent an image of a bag of marijuana and a condom.
Now, you know, we've talked about condoms being so frequently introduced into this. Now, can you finally admit that this is funny?
I mean, I can't quite put my head around the idea that someone, here, I'm going to put a dime bag and a condom. But, all right, so anyway, not funny, as usual. Most of the stuff you say is not funny. So the girl stopped interacting with Doe when she learned his age, at which point he became persistent, asked if he could meet her after school, and described the car he drove. After receiving the report, the police went to speak with Doe. Hey, but he wasn't home. That same day, the girl was at her bus stop when Doe drove by in the car he had described and asked if she had missed the bus. He then sent the girl a photograph of the area near her home, said that he sees her almost every day, and asked her to get out early and meet up with him. Now, I will say that this guy seems to have a problem.
Well, I would say he has sexual urges for sure. The girl also disclosed that Doe asked to have a threesome with her and her cousin, who had received similar types of messages from Doe. Although no charges were ever filed on those cases, the hearing examiner found that those allegations were substantially detailed, reliable, and credible, and showed that Doe had engaged in stalking behaviors.
Now, how much of this do you think impacted the board's hearing examiner?
I would say significantly. The hearing examiner considered other inappropriate behavior with girls, and the hearing examiner considered this information as indicative of the start of a pattern of persistence with females even when told to stop. That is not going to be a very attractive combination for having your risk level lowered when you've gotten away with so many things that are deemed fairly credible.
What is required for a level 3 classification? And is level 3 better or worse than a level 1?
A level 3 is not good.
Okay.
So, but in order to justify that classification, the board must find by clear and convincing evidence that the risk of reoffense is high and that the degree of dangerousness posed to the public is such that a substantial public safety interest is served by active dissemination of the offender's registration information, which means that the lower levels were not disseminated publicly. And this is so significant that anybody wants to read the opinion, it's on page 4. That part is, that's the standard that they have to meet as clear and convincing evidence. Chance, you're off script here, but can you tell people how powerful of a standard clear and convincing is so that we get a picture of what's necessary here?
Well, you could describe it as like almost never. It's a very, very high bar. So it's just rare. Let's put it that way. Rare. Anybody ever touches that.
So it's a high standard evidentiary. I've always tell people it's one step below beyond a reasonable doubt. Would that be an accurate description of that evidentiary standard, clear and convincing, as being the
next notch? Clear and convincing, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay.
Now, does the court second guess the hearing examiner?
No. In this process, the court does not. The court stated, quote, it's the province of the board and not the court to weigh the credibility of the witnesses and to resolve any factual disputes. And then they cite the supporting case law, which I won't read. And the court emphasized that they will reverse a decision of the board, quote, only if we determine that the decision is unsupported by substantial evidence, or is arbitrary and capricious, or an abuse of discretion, or not in accordance with the law. Now, those are very common standards for an administrative process to be overturned. That's the high level of deference that the administrative agency gets. So you've got to show one of those four things there. It's arbitrary, capricious, abuse of discretion, not supported by evidence, or just not in accordance with the law. That's the same exact standard that we have here. It's a pretty high thing to try to overturn an administrative process because that is the expert. That hearing examiner has been specially trained, knows how to get the evidence, how to view the evidence, how to conduct the proceeding, and that hearing examiner was able to evaluate those witnesses and determine how credible she felt they were.
Now, since you are Mr. Doom and Gloom, I'm guessing that you agree with the board's decision?
I do. And so does the court. They found that substantial evidence supports the board's decision in this case to classify Doe as a level 3 PFR. The index offenses triggered the application of statutory high risk factor 3, and that's an adult offender with a child victim. That's in their little cheat sheet. And the risk elevating factor 7, which was the relationship between the offender and victim. And then factor 9, alcohol and substance abuse. Factor 16, public place. And factor 19, level of physical contact. Those are significant factors that were considered, and Doe did not do well. The hearing examiner also appropriately gave substantial weight to the stalking behaviors that Doe committed in 2018 while the charges of the index offenses were pending. Now, we have a defense attorney, and he's getting ready to rip me apart for saying that. So what have I missed here? Because I think that this is a pretty solid case here. What do you say, Mr. Chance?
Well, first of all, let me go back a couple of steps, and let's reexamine this substantial evidence thing. And I probably got a little confused here. Tell me the standard again.
The standard the board has to meet to classify someone as a level 3 is clear and convincing evidence that they present a risk to the community and blah, blah, blah. So that standard is a pretty high one.
It's a high bar. And I was confusing that with the other standard you were talking about, which is challenging these things. But in any event, where am I? What was I thinking? We cannot, you know, it is, how would I put it? It's pretty interesting that they have these things kind of built in to it. I mean, this is probably a little bit more liberal than most systems, I would say.
Well, the way that it appears to work is they have the factors that justify a higher elevated risk. And he had several of those factors, you know, factor 3, factor 7, factor 9, factor 16, factor 19. And those factors were weighed against the evidence that was deemed to be credible. So he didn't do well under that risk system because of those factors. And that's the part I'm trying to show about risk-based systems. They're not the cure-all, end-all that people think they are.
Well, no, but, you know, also, you know, risk-based systems are created not for the benefit of registrants. You know, these risk-based systems are preferred for managing registrants because they offer a more tailored and effective approach to public safety. Public safety is really at issue here. Ultimately, risk-based systems aim to enhance public safety by reducing the likelihood of offending, which is going on here in this system. By focusing on high-risk individuals, these systems attempt to prevent future crimes and protect communities. That's what they're all about. And you've said it, I think, a moment ago, but I think your discomfort with them is that there's not enough due process to ensure effective review of arbitrary decision-making, which doesn't seem to be happening here.
Okay, well, I put you on the spot there off the script, but go ahead, Chance. My cursor's where we are.
Yeah, I gotcha. Let me ask you this, though. If these things happened before he was then convicted, and I don't know if we cover it later, he spent 2.5 years locked up. Has he been offense-free since he got out in 2020?
Yes, as far as we know.
Wouldn't that stuff weigh in there? Because this is all pre-conviction, before you've then slapped him on the wrist and said this is bad behavior.
You're making a good point. If you had been representing him, that would hopefully be a point that would have been made in the appellate process, as this was all post-conviction. But his conviction is not that long ago. You pointed out he was only released in 2020, so he doesn't have a longitudinal look of any significant duration before he went before the board asking for a reduction.
Right. And you've definitely brought up that there are problems with risk-based systems. Can you dig into that?
Sure. This case illuminates that there are significant issues with risk-based systems. We cannot assume that every individual will be satisfied with his or her assigned risk assessment, but I think this is a good example of someone who is not satisfied.
Definitely not satisfied. But that sounds reasonable. What else?
Also, we cannot assume that non-contact offenders will always be rated as low risk, because that's not at all what happens in the states that still utilize risk-based systems. And Chance, you've already said that.
Yes, I have.
So then you've raised questions for those who advocate for such systems. Could we go through your list?
Sure, we can.
What would the benefits to a registrant be? Should the person classified be classified as low risk or not be listed on the website? Should the registration periods be based on the outcome of risk assessment? Like, what are some of those things?
Well, I think in this case here in Massachusetts, you see that this is one of the things they would not be disseminating his information if he had been able to be a lower risk. But I think there should be a shorter period of registration and online exposure for lower risk offenders. But of course, I don't think there should be online for anybody, but we have to start somewhere. If we're going to have a risk-based system, that would be one benefit that I would really think that would be in order. This, why would you go through all the process of having these invasive tests done, including one that wraps a device on your private parts? Why would you go through all that if you were not going to derive any benefit from it? So, yes, I think that there should be some significant benefit.
A plethysmograph. Say that 5 times fast.
I can't say it one time.
What would the process look like? What do you think that would look like if a registrant disagreed with his or her risk level? And what would that appeals process be, would that be administrative or judicial?
Well, I'm always sensitive because I've been in the law business for a long time about how courts don't want more work. So I would prefer a process like what I see in Massachusetts, where there would be an administrative hearing officer. We call those administrative law judges. They're generally attorneys. That's why they're referred to as judges. And I'd prefer that the administrative law judge make the decision, and that perhaps there would be a second decision made administratively with a different administrative law judge or some sort of tribunal within the administrative agency. And then there would be a right to go to court if those processes failed, because the courts do not want all this work. They will fight tooth and nail to keep this stuff out of their domain.
And in whatever type of process they do come up, we need to know who would represent the state, as they would certainly have a say in the individual's risk determination.
Well, I don't know, but I'd prefer it not be the district attorney, but it begs the question, who would it be? District attorneys are elected, and they have public opinion to contend with, and having the district attorney represent the state seems like to me a recipe for a prolonged fight against everybody's risk level being higher than what it should be. So I don't know who it would be.
And then who would provide legal representation for the indigent registrants? And I'll up that one too. How do you make it so that they are all playing from the same playing field, that somebody that has the means to afford someone that would give them a favorable one versus something like a public defender representative for indigent registrants? Are they going to rate them as favorably? How do you make this a level playing field for those with the funds and those without?
Well, that's a question that I keep asking for those who are proponents, and it's unanswered, but I would want there to be those funds. A system is no system if only 50% of the people have access to it. So every PFR should have access to the same process. In California, I think Chance has told us it's the public defender's office for those who qualify for indigent representation. I don't know, we can speak on that in a minute about that process, but there needs to be funds for expert. There's so many things that we go into this. And Chance, tell us a little bit about that. If a person, how do they go about qualifying for that, for assistance from the public defender's office dealing with registration removals and the kind of stuff you said? You don't have this exact setup where you're lowering the risk level, but you are getting them off the registry. How does that process work?
Well, the public defender's office does this, and you certainly have a right to an attorney in this process. And because you have a right to an attorney in this process, if you're indigent and can't afford one, which means you've got to make application with the public defender's office. If they accept you and you're indigent, they represent you. And that's how it works, basically. And then everybody else who wouldn't qualify as indigent is either on their own or they've got to hire an attorney. You don't necessarily have to have one, but I think it's a good idea that you do, especially in our process.
So how would the indigent psychologist or other experts be compensated so that the process would be fair? And in this particular case, the court denied Doe's request for funds to hire an expert.
Yeah, I think this is where the procedural due process kind of falls apart, because it's an expensive game. And in order to get the answers right, you've got to have the right people involved in doing the work. And if it's short shrifted because maybe someone's indigent can't afford it versus someone who has the funds, you know, and is able to do it, you know, the disparity there is great. I don't know the answer to that. What do you think, Larry?
I agree with you. That's as an unanswered question that I keep posing those who want that here in my state. And we're not going to ever have that here, I don't think, in any time in my lifetime. But the courts would need to have funds allocated for such situations. And that would require a legislative appropriation. They already appropriate money for like the juror fund and for certain things for funding for indigent representation. But if this process is going to be remotely fair, we've got to give people access to resources that don't have those resources.
Anything else here before we close this segment down?
I say to those who want risk-based registration, be careful what you ask for. You may not like it as much as you think you would.
And I mean, just by contrast, though, if you do the tiered system and your crime was 400 years ago, you are still listed as being the person that you were convicted of back then, even though you're 20 or 40 or 60 years older. And as I believe most of them say, that you age out of your crimes, that why would you still be leveled as this terrible thing when you were 20 and now you're 60?
Well, I agree with you on that. But many states have gotten it wrong when they put those tiers together. They've put people in tiers they shouldn't be in. But there are people who would be in tier 3 legitimately. But the states have put far more offenses in tier 3 than what the guidelines recommend. So we got a twofold problem. We've got to teach our legislatures how to align the offenses in the right tiers. And then we've got to figure out a process to get people out of tier 3 because they don't need to be in there for a whole lifetime.
It seems like there has to be somebody that could create a hybrid. And I think that ends up to be like the static 99. And I don't necessarily want to be in favor of that either, but something that would give you points for how long has it been since your last infraction of any kind, things of that nature.
Well, you know, a static 99 is exactly what it is. It's static. It's just a photograph, really, of where you are at any given point, usually before the process starts. And there's not much that can change that. It's the dynamic that really is the most important thing. That's what California does. It starts with a static in terms of risk assessment. And then as a person progresses, it goes into the dynamic evaluation of, you know, is the needle moving a little bit? And so, you know, but that's not a completely satisfactory way to do it either. There's problems with both, and you know, these haven't been resolved yet.
Gotcha. Okay, then.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
So we're going to now go over to California, where the Supreme Court recently ruled that a convicted PFR, Kevin Scott Gray, can live near a home school in Stanislaus County. This decision has caused quite a stir in the community. Do you mind, Chance, giving us a brief overview of the case?
Okay, certainly. Kevin Scott Gray has a long history of sex crimes against children dating back to 1974. His offenses include molesting up to 50 children and exposing himself to girls younger than 11 more than 1,000 times. In July 2024, Gray was set to be released and placed in a home on Central Avenue, just 3 miles outside of Turlock, out of the Turlock city limits. However, the Stanislaus County District Attorney's Office filed a motion to stop this placement, citing concerns for community safety.
What happened next?
Well, in November, the state's 5th District Court of Appeal upheld the motion, stating that the area was too close to a home school. However, in December, Attorney General Rob Bonta, on behalf of the California Department of State Hospitals, took the case to the state Supreme Court. And on January 15th, the California Supreme Court agreed with the petition, allowing Gray to reside in the area without a written opinion.
Now, this decision has understandably caused a lot of concern among residents. One resident, Mindy Bruin, expressed her shock and disappointment, stating that the ruling ignores the safety and well-being of the community. Senator Marie Alvaro Gill also voiced her opposition, calling the decision outrageous and dangerous. Now, would you explain the reasoning behind the court's decision?
Okay, I'll give it a shot. The court's decision was based on a 36-page petition that argued against the precedent of considering homeschools as school institutions. The reasoning was that there are too many homeschools in California, making it difficult if almost impossible, to find placements for sexually violent predators. While this decision may be legally sound, it raised significant concerns about community safety.
And speaking of community safety, let's talk about the community safety plan that is developed when an SVP is released. How is this plan created, and what measures are in place to ensure their compliance?
Well, as I understand it, a community safety plan is developed at the Department of State Hospitals by the Forensic Conditional Release Program staff, referred to as SVP-CONREP, while the patient is still in the hospital. The plan is tailored to the individual's risk factors and treatment needs and includes input from hospital treatment staff and others involved in the patient's treatment and monitoring in the community. This plan lists the conditions of outpatient treatment and supervision that the individual must adhere to while in the community.
How does this plan ensure patient compliance then?
Well, this is where the rubber meets the road, because the plan includes extensive and detailed terms and conditions of outpatient treatment and supervision. These measures include announced and unannounced face-to-face visits, collateral contacts and chaperone training, covert surveillance, GPS monitoring with real-time tracking, monitoring of approved electronics, random urine screens, unannounced searches, banking and expenditure reviews, approval and verification of schedules, life skills training, and other services to support safe community reintegration. Additionally, the plan includes the use of polygraph exams, physiological assessments of sexual arousal, and assessments of sexual interest to monitor treatment progress and compliance.
Holy moly. Now, talking about narrowly tailored, Larry, that sounds very narrowly tailored. But what happens if a patient violates the terms of release?
Well, think about all the stuff I just said. If any of that stuff isn't right, if a patient violates the terms of release, the violations are reported to the court and can result in consequences for the patient, of course, up to and including revocation of conditional release and a return to the hospital pursuant to Penal Code Section 1610.
Wow. So thank you for providing such valuable insight to this complex issue. So Larry, do you want to chime in with anything?
No, I was glad that Chance could get this thing dissected. I wasn't able to put it together. So thank you for the work that you did and the help that AI gave you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So important. Yes. But I want to emphasize this one thing about all this. And
please.
That is, you know, when a court does it without opinion, and we've had the Taylor case in this state, and, you know, there's another thing about, you know, where you can place people, but, you know, the state is dense. If you're gonna say, well, you know, you can't be near a school and there's a home school in every house, where are you gonna put somebody? Like out in the desert somewhere? So this was not that complex, given, you know, all the safeguards and all the conditions and all the things that have to be met in these cases. It doesn't take much to get to the Supreme Court having to, you know, consider homeschools as school institutions, as school institutions for purposes of barring placement in the community, an afterthought. It's just not going to happen.
I wonder, how long has this guy been out of prison? So only since July, so not even a year yet?
Yeah, not long.
How long was he locked up for?
50 Ooh. Years.
Holy, like you got to let a guy out at some point in time.
So this case goes back, his behavior goes back to the 70s. He's been in custody in either prison or the state hospital for a very long time.
Jeepers. Okay. You got to give the guy a shot, don't you think? I mean, other than him having a lot of opportunities back in the day, so to speak. Holy moly.
Yeah, there's enough checks and balances there, I think, that I would never guarantee completely, but, you know, within reason, there's a lot of stuff that has to be adhered to.
And it's not like everybody that's a neighbor to this guy do not know. Everyone knows who this guy is, and they're going to, besides firebomb his house, they're certainly going to avoid him.
Oh, there's going to be problems, lots of issues and problems, of course.
Without a doubt.
But, you know, if in this case, if homeschools were considered schools, you would have no place in the whole world to release anybody in this state.
And even if the dude was 20 years old when he got locked up, now he's 70, he has no idea how to use an ATM machine. I mean, like, as a fundamental technology that people just expect to go to their bank and press a few buttons and draw 20 or 40 bucks out, the guy has no clue.
Yeah, go figure.
And Mr. Social Security over there, he has no points or whatever it's called for him to draw Social Security money.
He has no credits in his Social Security account. That is true. He would be on SSI at best.
Right. And that's going to be a pretty meager living.
Yeah. Well, at the federal level, it's just shy of $1,000 a month. And in states like California, supplement it with a few hundred dollars. But it's still a meager existence.
And California is expensive. And where was this?
Oh, Stanislaus.
Where is
up
that?
Up north.
Like San Francisco up north or north?
No, a little bit before that, I think.
Okay. Would it be a reasonable cost of living?
I suppose a little bit better. It's not okay. San Francisco. It's not Southern California. It's, right. It's, you know, somewhere within the reasonable range.
All right, then. All right. Well, then I threw this in there, and it's almost playing it to you both cold, but you've both heard it. So anywho, here's a voicemail that someone left, and it will speak for itself. It's a question about how bad the registry is.
Hello, yes. I wonder if y'all can any way possible see if there's any way that y'all can tried to get rid of the laws where people have to register, because these registering laws are doing they're basically indescribably. I mean, there's no nationality behind it. There's no rationality behind it. We get a sex offender in the White House, and now you have to go ahead and sign up. If you got any sex offenses for an employment job, or you got sex offenses next door. So we got a sex offender in the White House. So why should we have to go ahead and go for look at what's coming up. Come on, please broadcast it out there that you got a sex offender in the White House, and don't beat any bones about it. God bless you now. God bless.
I know you want to touch on the first point, Larry.
Well, just because we played that doesn't mean that we endorse that. That is
agreed
for humor, but we do not have a sex offender currently in the White House. And on Monday, we won't have a sex offender in the White House. He has not been convicted of any sexual offenses. And I promote intellectual honesty. And this is certainly not an intellectually honest statement. So I reject what he says, but yes, I would like the registry to go away, but I don't like what he said there about a sex offender in the White House.
He has like a 50s accent almost.
I wanted to make sure that part,
because I bet you a ton of people, even those that listen to this in our ranks, would say that he is a convicted sex offender, and he is not. He got convicted in civil court and whatnot. He did not get convicted in criminal charges of being and ending up a sex offender.
Yeah, and convicted in civil court is not even used that way. He was found civilly liable, but it's not
a conviction. I understand. I gotcha. And then in basically saying, y'all need to try and get rid of these laws. Like, you called the organization that is trying to get rid of these laws, tamp them down, reduce them as much as possible, to then just say, y'all got to get rid of them. Like, step up and help out then.
Yeah, and quit voting for people who promise to make these laws harsher. And I bet he's one of those who does that. And then he rolls his head and doesn't understand why, which is the most mind-boggling thing to me, is that people vote contrary to their interests, and then they're shocked when they get what they get. But anyway, that's another show altogether.
Chance, would you like to offer some comments?
Yeah, I think that Larry's right. People are shocked after they vote. But you know what? Buyer beware, man. You really got to study and think about things before you do them. Think before you do. And, there's just something about our system that just causes this kind of broken record effect happening over and over and over again. It's kind of strange.
Any parting words before we close it all down and have a wonderful rest of our weekend?
Look forward to seeing everyone in a week or so.
Yeah.
Very well.
Yep.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chance. Thank you, Larry. As always, and you can head over to registrymatters.co to find show notes, and then you can do the phone number thing at 747-227-4477. registrymatterscast@gmail.com to leave me an email message, and then I will forward it over to Larry and Chance. And then, of course, thank you very much to all the patrons at patreon.com/registrymatters to support us for even as little as a dollar a month. But those, what were they? Stimulus checks. That's a fine amount as well. Thank you guys very much, and I will talk to you very soon.
Thank you. Have a great night.
You've been listening to FYP.